Now, please join me in extending a warm welcome to our special guest tonight, Tom I. from South Pines, North Carolina.
Well, thank you, folks, very much. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. I'm delighted to see you. It's a really AA and around here. That's for doggone sure. And I am delighted to be here. Great to see a bunch of old friends. Great to see some new friends. Great to see those celebrations. Congratulations on the chips. That's just absolutely phenomenal. And if you're new here, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're in for the trip of your life. And I'm here to tell you it can be an absolute hoot. My sobriety date is February the 2nd of 57. And, yes, so, thank you very much. You know, some people tell you that when you come in, you sort of get in a honeymoon period, a pink cloud, and that it has a rather predictable life cycle, and then I guess you tail off to mediocrity or something. I don't know, whatever it is, I haven't gotten there yet. I'm still on a pink cloud. I'm still having as much fun as I've ever had in my life. I'm still as enthused about Alcoholics Anonymous as I've ever been in my life, and so mine's not a tale of woe. Mine's a tale of get them up, and let's keep on going. So welcome, and I hope you'll jump in this sucker and get everything you possibly can, because there's a lot here to get. And I am delighted. It's great to be back in Portland. I'm amazed that it's raining. Just it hardly ever does that here. And we've had, my wife is with me on this trip, and that's a rare luxury for me. Just stand up. I just want you to see that I'm not as bad as I look. Look what I married. I really wanted to introduce the Northwest, and we've been hiding in umbrellas and windstorms ever since we've been here. And I am really glad she's here, and it is good to be back. And what I want to do is just sort of tell you what we do. We tell our stories. You know, we don't teach and preach and lecture here. Might have sounded like it at the workshop. We had a really good workshop this morning on home group and primary purpose, and very stimulating and a nice experience. And tonight I just want to tell my story, at least some form of it. And it'll be true. I'm just never sure where it's going. I don't have a real polished kind of presentation. I just start somewhere and then quit. Well, I sort of perfected a little bit of a technique. I like to quit about 2 minutes before you do. If you've ever done much talking, you know, you can tell when a crowd quits. And there's no verbal signal, but all at once it's kind of like the eyes glaze over. You know, they sort of sit there comatose. You can talk on if you want to, but you're done. I mean, it's all over. Yeah. So I like to get about 2 minutes ahead of that if I can. And what I want to do in telling my story, if I had an objective, it would be to, I guess, maybe share with you about the hopelessness of the illness, because it truly is a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I want to share with you that there's a real solution for that. That you can actually stay sober for a long time, and you can actually grow into enjoying a life that's beyond anything you ever imagined. And so I want to share that. If there's anybody here that wonders if there's a future, I want to try to lay a little hope that there is, no matter the situation, that there is hope here that's tangible and real and realizable through a very, very direct process. Now, I'll introduce it all night, and then to have to struggle to try to get it done. So I'm just going to jump in. Good God. Tried to suck some water, my ears popped. I am no longer a bottle baby, I tell you. Now that's drinking. God, that's terrible. Booby traps again. I want to just kind of cut in and go at it. I'm a guy, and I'm sure that this will have meaning for everybody here who has this illness or who's observed it. I'm a guy who found himself when the fog cleared, and I had some clear awareness of who I was, where I was, what my life had become, and when that cleared for me, and I took a look around at where I was a 24-year-old guy sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary, serving a 15-year sentence for a crime that I had absolutely no recollection of committing then, now, or ever, but one that I know full well I did commit, a crime so horrible that there's no adequate punishment for it. There is none. I had taken the lives of two people. I could be nice to myself and say that it was an unavoidable accident. I don't know. What I know is that I was blind drunk driving blacked out down the main street of a city in the state of Michigan and ran over and killed two people. And so when I came to the awareness of where I was and who I was and what had transpired in my life, it was not a good picture to look at. Nothing about it. The current situation was untenable at best. And so when I sat there and tried to reflect a bit on, and this is how I want to tell the story tonight, I just want to sort of get at it in a good chunk, because the details don't matter so much. It's the thing of the devastation of a human life. And so when I looked at that situation, there was no welcoming direction to look. There was nothing I could look at comfortably or with any sense of satisfaction. And I'll just mention three areas of life and what it looked like at that point in my life. When I looked at my history and what had transpired that brought me there, it was not a nice picture. I look back at the first 24 years of my life, and this is not a soap opera or melodrama. This is the God's truth. At the age of 24, I couldn't think of, then or now, could not think of one redeeming act or accomplishment that I had performed in my life that was worth talking about. Nothing. I'd never completed anything to fruition. Never held a job for as much as a year. A lot of them I didn't want to hold for a year. I never held one for as much as a year, except the Army. And I didn't want to hold that one. I kept trying to quit. And every time I'd quit, they'd come get me and put me in jail. And I held that one for more than a year, but it wasn't of my volition, I promise you that. They finally got tired of messing with me and threw me out with an undesirable discharge. When I was a 20-year-old guy, and I'm found unfit for military service because of alcoholism when I'm 20. And so when I look back, that's what I saw. Was just a period of life characterized by failure and disappointment in everything that I tried to do. I mean, there was nothing, and that's the God's truth. I couldn't think of one human in my life in those first 24 years that would not have literally been better off if they had never seen me. I couldn't think of anybody who was unfortunate enough to get close to me that didn't get hurt in the process, didn't get dirty in the process, and wind up hurt, humiliated, disappointed, frustrated, angry, used, abused. Not a soul, not anybody in that first 24 years. And so it was a loser syndrome. I started drinking. I dabbled with it all of my life. I started serious drinking when I was 16, where I got into show enough drinking, show enough liquor, all I wanted. And from that point forward, my life changed. And so booze became a powerful factor in my life. What it became for me was a solution. And some people say booze quit working for them. That's the saddest story I've ever heard. Yeah, it never quit working for me. That sucker worked for me right up till the last day. Unfortunately, it just worked overtime. It worked too good. But I'm not somebody. I always found booze to be the most reliable friend I ever had. I never went to booze and I didn't get what I was looking for. Unfortunately, the solution became the problem. But that was what characterized that losing legacy that was my life. So when I started drinking, I looked like a born alcoholic. I don't think I was. I was a guy that was just sort of like you hear all the time. I found this place uncomfortable, this world uncomfortable place to be, and Boo solved that stuff for me. And I just fell in love with it, took it up as a way of life, and I would be doing it today except for one thing. I developed alcoholism. Don't know why, don't care why. Don't have that much interest in it. I've learned more about it than I ever wanted to know. Most of it is fairly interesting, but almost totally unimportant in terms of my recovery from alcoholism. What I know, without any question whatsoever, is that something happened to me that doesn't happen to the average cat. I lost the ability to control my drinking. I love that definition. Somebody today talked about the definition that's found in the big book that characterizes alcoholism as loss of control. Most important line in the book for me in that context is that simple little sentence in the third chapter that says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. I love that definition. I love it because it's straight up. It gets right to the heart of the matter. It has nothing to do with circumstances or misfortune. It has to do with something that's uniquely different with me than the average cat who drinks. If I drink, I cannot predict what I will do. And so when I started to drink, it was absolutely Katie bar the door. There was no stopping. I didn't stop because it was a good idea. I don't recall ever in the middle of a drunk saying, oh, my God, it's time to go to work. I didn't think about stuff like that. I stopped when I hit the wall. And there are all kinds of walls to hit, psych wards, hospitals, jails, ad infinitum, God knows, just a ton of stuff. And so when I looked at that life, that was a loser in the making. I developed alcoholism when I was 18 years old. Didn't know that till I got sober and looked back. So when I looked at that first segment of my life, you know, what am I looking at? It's just a legacy of losing, and this illness is what undergirded that whole process. When I looked at the future, there was no future. I mean, it was like looking in a dark cave. There was no future. I didn't aspire to a future. I felt deeply ashamed to be breathing, for God's sakes, when two fine young people no longer were because of me. And so I couldn't fathom the notion of living again. I couldn't fathom the notion of trying to find a solution to anything. All I wanted to do at that point was just sort of disappear if I could. And so there was no future. It was just a kind of a dark place to look. And there was nothing in it for this guy. And so that's what I was looking at. When I looked at the current situation, you know, I'm sitting in the Michigan State Penitentiary in a place called Jackson. And when I was in there, and I imagine it's still true today, when I was in there, it was the largest walled institution in the world. That'd be a weird status symbol, but I guess typical alcohol, if you're going to be in one, you got to be in the biggest one in the world. You know, that's where I was sitting. And I'm 24 years old. I'm sitting in that joint. Normally, they didn't keep guys my age in maximum custody. They never let me out of maximum custody. I stayed here the whole time I was in. And it wasn't because I was Charles Manson on a rampage. I was not a predatory criminal. You know, there are two basic types of, well, there are a lot of types, but there, if you're going to really break it down generally, there are two basic types of folks in prison. There are some people who commit crime and happen to drink. And they would probably go to prison if they didn't drink. Now, those are folks that have a sort of a criminal commitment. It's either a business or a fetish or I don't know what it is. You know, it ain't a bad business, really, because a lot of people do it. But that's one type. I'm not that type. There's another type that's called a casual offender. Now, I don't mean to talk about criminology or all that kind of stuff, but there's a casual offender would be people like most of us in this room. There are people whose inappropriate or criminal behavior is a direct result of their alcoholism. And that's exactly what I was. I wasn't somebody who wantonly took human life. I'm an alcoholic doing what most of the folk in this room have done innumerable times. And that's to drive, and for folks like people like me, to drive a vehicle in a city or anywhere is like firing a weapon down the street and hoping it doesn't hit somebody. And that's exactly what I was. And so I was what they classify as a casual offender. casual offenders, they normally don't keep in maximum custody. But I think what they did was looked at my record and said, my God, don't let this guy see daylight, because my record was bizarre at best. And I lived it. I knew it was bizarre. They found out. And so they never let me see any daylight. And what I was a fellow sitting in an environment that was, and I won't go into a whole bunch of detail about it. It's an unthinkable environment. And for those of you who've been there, no definition or description is required. For those who don't, it's kind of hard to imagine. But it's hard to imagine an environment where 24 hours a day are filled with tension and fear and angry and man's inhumanity to man. And it's just the way the environment works. Nobody plans it. It's just as the way it works, where predatory behavior is the rule of the day, a place where kindness is considered weakness, where sincerity is considered stupidity, you know, a kind of place that does not reinforce or encourage positive growth experience. It's a place where survival is the order of the day. It's a place where I've had to walk on the yard knowing that God knows I didn't want to hurt anybody else. But I've had to walk out on that yard knowing that I may have to kill somebody or I may have to be killed. But it just comes to it, and there's no place to hide. If you run for the rest of your life. And so it's not a nice place. You know, it's not a place that's conducive to any kind of positive stuff. I say that just simply to make the point that if you looked at a case like this, you know, I'm a guy sitting in a cell in a maximum custody joint with what I'm looking at is what I've just described. I'm sitting in that cell staring at my navel doing anything I can do to keep from thinking, because thinking hurts. And so I'd read anything. I could read a matchbook cover for an hour. You know, anything to keep from thinking. And if you looked at that, if you looked at the kind of a guy, and I've given you the country club version, but if you looked at a guy like that and said, let's pick out a winner out of these 6,000 cats in here, I'll guarantee you, you would have passed that cell by. It simply underlines one thing that I believe with all my heart. And I don't mean to yank you under my tent. But when I say that I am grateful for what's happened in my life, you believe that. I think that I am among the luckiest people on God's green earth. I truly believe that. And I have taken the liberty of believing the same thing is true for you, that we're the luckiest folk on God's green earth. The fact is that most alcoholics in this world, you know, if you put, you know, we say we've got some roughly 2 million people who are members of AA. That sounds like an impressive number. If you look at the world population of alcoholics, we wouldn't even make a decent blip on the radar screen. We're such an infinitesimal, small part of the alcoholic population that, my God, it just gives me shivers when I think about how unlikely a guy like me would be able to be given this gift. God knows, I don't take that for granted. I am grateful every day of my life. Not just because of my experience, just because of the experience of alcoholics. Most of us die drunk. And most of us never know there's a real solution. And so I am deeply, deeply grateful to just be one of that crowd of however many we are. And I am so deeply grateful for that. But if you had looked at that guy, you would not have bet much on that guy. Yeah, there was a fella, his name was Soren Kierkegaard, who... I couldn't understand his writing. I can barely pronounce his name. But he was a smart guy from over in Europe somewhere. He was a deep thinker type of guy. And he said something. He said it in a lot of fancy language, but it had a resounding message for me. What he said in my language was what God would use, he first reduces to nothing. That's what Kierkegaard said. Yeah, he said it in different words, but that's what it says to me. What God would use, he first reduces to nothing. Why was a guy like successfully? And the wife was going to take me out. She was going to buy my anniversary dinner. And we started out the back door, phone rang, I went over and answered it. And somebody answered it. And said, it's Doug. And I said, oh, okay. So I went over and talked, found out what it was, and he was in detox, dying again. So I answered it and said, okay. She said, you're going, aren't you? And I said, yeah, we'll eat later. Well, I mean, she's used to that, you know, so we'll eat later. So I go over to the hospital, go into the detox ward, and here's this guy. I mean, you talk about sick. This puppy is sick. I mean, big time. I could hear him moaning down the hall. And so I walked in. And, boy, I'm telling you, he looked like death barely warmed over. I mean, that guy was about gone, man. He was about gone. And I said, hey, big guy, how you doing? And good God, he let out a yowl. I told him, I said, oh, boy, I'm going to tell you something. You'll never know how glad I am to see you in this condition. And then he really yowled, you know. And I said, that's not going to make a bit of sense to you, but you remember this, because one day you will agree with what I'm saying. Because that guy looked like what Kierkegaard was inspired to write about. You know, what God would use, he first reduces to nothing. If I'd have gone in there, the guy would have been jacked up, smoking a cigarette and reading the Wall Street Journal. I'd have said, hi, big guy, nice to see you. Give me a call when you get out. But no, I saw a guy that was at the point of ready. And so what looks hopeless to the untrained eye to us looks like this is that moment. This is that moment. And so while my situation might have looked untenable and impossible, I could not have understood it, but I probably could never have been more ready than I was at that time. I'd been on bottom a number of times, but this time I was on bottom for a sustained period adequate to start hearing something. And so I'll tell you what happened to turn. Is it all right if I take my coat off? You don't mind? Jeez. It's a nice coat. Okay. You got to watch ball guys in Portland. They'll take you out. And there's a lot of them. I never saw so many. Yeah. But I tell you what happened, and I went into all of that to say that when it looks like there's nothing left, you know, God doesn't bargain. He says, when you're done, when you're ready, come to me. That's what was going on. I didn't know anything about it. And so what happened? Amazing how simple most profound things are. Amazing how simple it was. The things that started to turn that life around. Now, I wasn't looking for anything. Man, I'm feeling guilty for every breath I take. I could not have asked for help under any conditions. I could not. You know, if somebody had waited on me to be ready, you know, like you hear us sometimes grandly say, oh, when you get enough, you'll come in baloney. You know, I would have never made a move. I was so full of guilt, I couldn't ask anybody what time it was, much less, would you help me? No, there's no way. My prophecy would have come true. I would have never lived to get out of there. And so what happened, a called me out for an interview one day, did a social history like every caretaker does, and went through the same old litany of stuff of who you are and what have you done and all this kind of stuff. When he got through with it, he made the same startling discovery that everybody had made. Only diagnosis I ever had was something like, you're an alcoholic, you're drunk, you're a problem drinker, and on and on and on. This guy was no exception. He got through and he said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah, that was obvious. You know, that anybody drank as much as I did would have trouble with booze. I mean, it's just natural. It's what it does. So he said that, and then he said something I'd never heard before. Normally folks would say, you ought to quit drinking or something like that. This guy, now this predated treatment, this predated detox. Well, we had detox, but kind of like we were talking about, we had a different name for them. We called them jails back then. they worked very well, but it required repeated treatment. So anyway, but it was very effective. A blackjack is a very great therapeutic tool. It'll work. And so that period predated all that stuff. There was no such thing as capturing drunks and taking them in and healing them against their will and all that. It just didn't happen. And so this guy, he got through it. He exclaims, man, you had a lot of trouble with booze. And then he said what I'd never heard before. He said, we have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go. Now, it wasn't a nice invitation or not even an explanation. I'd never heard of AA. I never heard of anybody doing anything for a drunk except locking them up or patching them up, you know, whichever was in order. I never heard of anything like that. I didn't know AA didn't mean anything to me. I don't think he tried to explain it because I don't think he knew. Somebody told him, when you see a guy's got a file that thick and it's all about booze, tell him he ought to go to AA. Well, that's exactly what he did. They probably paid him $100,000 that year for telling me, you ought to go to AA. It was worth it. God, it was worth it. I hope he didn't pay him that. And so I didn't know what he's talking about. I think somebody must have told me. I don't remember. But I sort of, or maybe it was just the mental image. You know, I was not thrilled about the prospects of going. I learned it was called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, that's not a thrilling name. I mean, who want to join that drum and bugle corps? Alcoholics, secret drunks. Everybody wants to be one of them, you know. And so I think I had that image, and I was not thrilled about going. I didn't want to go mix up with people. He sent me a little note and said, you can go to your first meeting. You had to be on a list to go because they had 300 members in that group, and it was crowded. And so you had to have a seat before you get in. And so he sent me a note and said, you can go to your first meeting. It didn't say Groundhog Day, but that's what it was, February 2nd of 57. And I was not overjoyed with that. I didn't particularly want to go to AA. I didn't not want to go. I wanted to sit in my cell and stare at my navel. The last thing I want to do is get out and mix with people and get into a whole bunch of how-do-you-do stuff. That's not what I want to do. But I was blessed with what Kierkegaard was talking about. I was reduced to nothing. I didn't even have fight left. There was nothing left. And so when I got that message, it was just almost like a trained move where I just sort of shuffled over to the meeting. Had no earthly idea what to expect. I thought it was going to be kind of like an old tent revival like we do down south sometimes. I thought sure as well it wouldn't be there very long before somebody come out shaking a snake or something. I couldn't imagine anybody helping drunks without doing something like that. You know? So I said very, very edgy when I walked in. A huge group. It looked like this. Huge group. 300 members. One guy spoke to me. They had an officer on the door. He read my name off my shirt. He said, sit down. So I sat out in the middle of that 300. No idea what to expect. They ran it much like this. It wasn't nearly as good looking a crowd, but it was a vigorous crowd. They ran it much like this, read a lot of stuff. I didn't know what they were reading. I mean, it sounded like poetry to me. I couldn't imagine what on that. They prayed. I knew they were going to do that. Same prayer we use here. Scared me to death, man. Spiritual life was a non-factor for me. I promised myself before I ever started school that I would quit that, because I got drug into some of that rock'em sock'em fundamental drum beating stuff down south, and it just drove me nuts. I mean, as a kid, I didn't even know how the world worked, but I knew it didn't work like that. And so I said, if I ever get out of there, I'm out. And I stayed that way. Man, where there should have been a spiritual life, I had a cold, empty space. And that's it. And so it was flinchy for me to walk in there and they're doing all this praying and stuff. Now, it ain't a very long prayer, but it's long when you feel like me. And so I got through that and read that stuff, said like to read the scriptures or something. And then they turned the speaker loose. Now, if you think I'm bad, you should have heard that guy. I mean, that guy told a story I wouldn't have told anybody. I mean, nobody. I'd never heard a story. I've heard drunks tell stories, but not their own. Yeah, that guy had to be telling the truth. Nobody's going to make that stuff up. I mean, it was bizarre. I'd been on the street for a good while, and I was about as near shockproof as a guy could get, but that shocked me.
I said, why on earth would he come in here and get 300 hairy-legged convicts and undress like that? Made no sense. And so we finished the meeting. When I walked out, probably more confused than I was when I came in. And the amazing thing was I was back the next week. Nobody sent for me. I didn't have to go. If I hadn't been, if I'd been where Dave said, I'd have been an empty chair. Nobody would have said who sits there. It didn't matter. They wouldn't even know when I was gone or cared. I'm just one more tragic face in a sea of tragic faces. Nobody would have cared about that. But for some strange reason, I found myself drawn back. I was drawn back. It was not, not any real force, that I was aware of. But you know how you sort of get drawn to something, like we were talking about, when you get something on your heart, you're drawn in that direction. That I was just sort of drawn back. I couldn't have told anybody why I was back. Nobody cared. I'm just back. And I went at it. And that was my start. And thank God the group that I went into, we were talking about groups today. Thank God I didn't get into some rinky-dink chat room. Thank God I got into a good, solid, for real group of Alcoholics Anonymous that understood the primary purpose and carried it out as well as any group I've ever seen. Thank God for that, because I'd have been dead meat if I'd have got into some sort of do-nothing, mind-boggling numbness. It takes something that's got some substance to it for an aggravated case like me. And so I'm just so grateful for that recovery group. It'll always be my home group. The recovery group at the State Prison of Southern Michigan will always be my home group. I just don't want to be a regular member. I'll let my replacement take care of that. But what happened, I didn't get struck pure. I was afraid I would, but I didn't get struck real quick with awareness or anything. I didn't believe I was alcoholic. I'm 24 years old. Somebody had told me one time I had a lot of potential, and I believed it. Yeah, they told me a lot of other stuff that I didn't believe, but I believed that I had a lot of potential. One of these days, I'm going to really break out and be a rocket scientist. And so I went, and that group, part of what they did was they took, it's part of what conditions me to believe in treating newcomers in a special kind of way. The way that group functioned, they'd take the new guys coming in, and I'm not talking about important Bill Wilson from New York, but they would take some of the older members in the group, and they'd come in and meet with the newer guys and tell them what they knew about what this program is about. That little simple gathering like that, just a bunch of guys in the joint talking together, is the first place I ever heard the term design for living. And it has never lost one ounce of importance for me that I heard then. Because what that helped me do was to get some context on what AA was. This is not some heavenly magic show where God's going to perform tricks just to show you that he's real. None of that. That it was a solid design for living. And what the guy said, and I found it to be true, I've said it 1,000 times myself, that these steps constitute a design for living. There are 200 words. And the function of this design for living in those 200 words is that if I take the actions laid out in those steps, when I get through, I'll be a different dude. Now, I'll be the same guy. I won't look any different. I won't have a brain transplant. But when I get through, I'll be a different guy in terms of having a whole new outlook on life. We call it a spiritual awakening. We call it a psychological realignment. We call it a lot of things. But just simply taking those actions. The guy said, and I found it to be true, that motives don't matter. Motives don't really matter, because if you'll take those actions, by the time you get through, your motives will be right. It has been so long since I've even wasted one ounce of thought about anybody's motives for being in AA, I couldn't care less. Motives are your business. They're not mine. I don't know of anybody who just decided that AA would be a wonderful association to join. Everybody's got some devil snapping at them somewhere, whatever it is. Very rarely does anybody come in just because it's a good idea. And so that motives really don't matter. We don't check resumes. We don't check purity of intent. What we deal with is broken lives. That's what we deal with. And so I'm grateful for that. That the guys helped me to understand in a very workable kind of way that this is not some kind of mystical thing. Yeah, I had the notion that you just sat in meetings and that for some fortunate few, some heavenly thing would descend on you and you'd get struck pure. Yeah. And so this changed that so that AA is a very practical. I tell you this, the last, oh God, what I guess probably more than 30 years of my professional career was in management. And my whole life was made up of planning and development and research and projections and all of that stuff and evaluation. You know, my whole life was about designs for production or designs for operation. I have never seen a more logical, clear design for anything than what is laid out in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Amazingly, amazingly simple, forthright thing. Tells me exactly what will happen if I do the action. Tells me even more clearly what will happen if I don't. And so it's a great, great thing. And I thank God for that introduction. I thank God for the people. I know there are people in here who come into prisons. Thank you for going. I may not be in there, but I'm spiritually connected to those who are. So I appreciate anybody who goes into those places to stick out the hand of hope. Good Lord. If it hadn't been for folk like that, you'd have a different guy here tonight. You can hurry up and believe that. And so that was tremendously important. Those things started to give me some hope I was talking about, of feeling connected to decent people, to being connected to a logical program. And so I started, back then we didn't do a lot of well-ordered, planned work through the steps. Sometimes we romanticize the old days like we did it better back then. We were really more haphazard than we are now, you know, that. Yeah, that very much in vogue when I came in was this notion, I've heard it a million times, of cafeteria style. You know, work the steps. If you go through, if you work what you like, you skip the rest, you can come back to it later. Well, I mean, I heard that forever. So it was sort of a catch-as-catch-can process. I did the first three steps with the God of logic. You know, I kind of accepted the fact that I had a lot of trouble with booze. I thought what people in AA were saying was that they were alcoholic because when they drank, they got in trouble. I thought, well, God, if that's what it is, I've got that. And I've had that all my life. I've been in trouble all my life. Always drunk. I've never been in trouble sober in my life. And so I kind of logically said, yeah, I did that too. And so but that has nothing to do with alcoholism, the illness. But it was enough, thank God, it was enough to get me going, eh? You know, one of the things that I, among the many things that I value in our book, is that it's not exacting. You know, what it says in there is just a willingness to believe is enough to get going. Thank God for that, that you don't have to be further along the road to get going, just a willingness to make a go. And I'm deeply, deeply thankful for that. And so I started fumbling around. I got the first three steps, and I'll tell you where a major turning point for me was. You know, at that point, it was a tenuous hold. I knew that I had trouble with booze. I knew that this program constituted a power, and what I felt in this constituted a power that I didn't understand but didn't deny. I knew there was a power greater than me. And so I had those first three steps as kind of a life raft in a stormy sea. And then the thing that was a definitive place for me that started to put some real power into the program of recovery for me was in the fourth step. And like me, and I've always been a reader. I mean, I was a guy coming off speed when I was in there. I swear to God, I took enough speed to launch Sputnik. Man, I took a lot of that stuff, and it'll make you quick, real quick. And so I was a reader. I read everything we had the first week. I mean, it didn't take long. Didn't understand it, but it was we're gone. And so I understood something about this inventory process, at least intellectually. But knowing what's in the program, it has no connection to doing it. You know, it's a whole different experience. And so what happened, one day I went to a meeting, turning point in my life, huge turning point. Went to a meeting, guy spent the entire meeting talking about four step, nothing else. Went into great detail about it, stressed the importance of writing it. And I'd sort of been mentally inventory. You know, if you talk about an exercise in futility, mental inventory, and I don't care how bizarre it is, if I don't tell anybody, it'll make sense to me. If as long as I lock it in my head, I don't care. It doesn't get too weird. And But I'd been thinking about how such a nice fellow as me got in such a mess, you know. And so what when that guy got through with that, I said, all right, I'm going to go do that. So I went to my cell, got out the old trusty legal pad, started to do what I was intended was to write a little story about how cruel life was and what a victim of circumstance. That's what I meant to do. But the founders were wise when they said to write it, because I wrote two lines, and this is absolutely the way it happened. I wrote two lines of what I had in mind, and then it was as if I just hit a jolt, and there was no big thunder or anything, but all at once I think I saw the sham and pretense and illusion that was my entire life. That was my life. My whole life was delusion and illusion. I didn't have a clue about who I was and what I was about. And I think all at once that came into focus, and I saw clearly who I was for the first time in my life. And in one motion, with absolutely no preparation, no guideline, no nothing, all I had was a legal pad and a pencil, and all at once I just opened up. And in one motion, I went from that little charade and opened up and just poured out my heart. That's all. It wasn't any work of art. It wasn't a real analytical kind of an inventory as is laid out in the book and as I did later. But when I finished it, what it was a tortured young man pouring out his heart. That's all. And when I got through with that, I had three pages of hopeless scribble. Nobody could have read it. Nobody's supposed to. That's my inventory. Nobody ever read that. That is mine. And I'll tell you this, I've done others that were more substantial later, and I'm not an inventory freak. In 48 years, I've done three. And so I'm not somebody who inventories every time I get in traffic jams. You know, I mean, that's living. So anyway, I did that thing, and I'll tell you, when I got through with that, I was a different man. I was a different man in the sense that when I got through with it, I knew at a cellular level that I was alcoholic, not the young guy or the tragic case or the whiz kid, none of that. I knew I was alcoholic, period. I've got an illness, and I knew it. I knew I was beat. I knew I was absolutely beat and it was hopeless that I cannot drink. That was the realization of God. I'm one of those people, for whatever reason, that if I take a drink, I self-destruct. And so drink is not an option. Some people say they're restored to choice. Not me. I have no choice. You know, I could opt for alcoholic insanity. I don't have a choice about drink or stuff like that. That day, I accepted the fact that I can't drink. And I'll tell you, there's a monumental difference in my mind between two simple statements. I can't drink is an act of surrender. I won't drink is an act of will. And it's a whole different process, and I think critically important for me to accept at depth that I'm beat. Man, it's over. And I can kid myself if I want to, but I am beat. And I'll tell you the real value of that. In 48 years, I have never for one second doubted that, not one nanosecond. I have never doubted that since. That's surrender at depth. And I believe that's the touchstone for spiritual growth, because that's what happened. I mean, it was over for this guy. That day, I've never been the same man. I've never fought that battle. I've never fought it one single time in all these years. It's done. That war is over. Now, I could resume it. It doesn't take much to resume it. But that war is over. That debate has been long ended. And so that's at peace. I'll never be bothered again physically by alcohol. I'll never be bothered by craving unless I do one thing, and that's take a drink. If I don't take a drink, I look just like any other human being. It did an MRI on me a while back, you know, just trying to see what made me act funny. And they did that thing. I guess they examine every molecule in your body or something. Well, when I came out of there, nobody said, my God, look, he's an alcoholic. Nobody. I look like anybody else, you know. But I know there's something constitutionally different about me than other people. So that was an important step for me. That day I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Didn't sign a pledge, didn't join up anything, didn't tell anybody. But I have never gone to an AA meeting from that day to this and been lost facing the crowd. I just don't do that. I've never gone to a meeting without knowing 100% why I'm there. I know why I'm here tonight. Part of it's because Chris asked me. That's part of it. But I don't ever want to get it's about doing favors or reciprocal trade. You know, I'll ask him for something one day. But it's not about reciprocity. I'm here for one reason. I believe very much that when I share from the bottom of my heart about where I was broken and where I was healed, that it has a power. It has a power. It has a usefulness. And somebody will connect with it. And that's why I do it. It makes me stronger. It makes me a better member. It makes me feel good to be trying to do God's will. And so I know why I'm here. Absolutely no question. And I have been lost or lonely in AA for a long, long time. If I go into unfriendly groups, and I do that once in a while, I don't let them be friendly very long. I mean, I don't let them be unfriendly. Yeah, I don't mind one bit welcoming people to their own group. Yeah, it doesn't bother me. I'm not going to tolerate Alcoholics Anonymous being a lonely, distant, unresponsive group. And I went into a meeting down in a little town below us a while back to speak to the group, and I was just walking around, working the crowd a little bit, getting to know people. And I walked through this one lady I didn't know, and I introduced myself, and we chatted for just a second. And I walked over to the side of the room. She came over, and she said, "Can I ask you a personal question?" I said, "Of course you can. What is it?" She said, "What do you sell?" I said, "Nothing." Wait a minute. I do. I sell recovery. And, man, we got a heck of a deal on that thing. And that's true. That is what I sell. I don't sell recovery by teaching people how distant and unresponsive I can be. I sell recovery by letting people know, man, this is fun. This is a heck of a good way to go. And so I do that. I mean, I just do that as a matter of principle. And also because I just don't like unfriendly places. And so I just try to convert them. Most of the time it works. Once in a while I'll run into one that is slam committed to, I mean, this ain't going to budge, you know. But you get one or two. Anyway, that's what happened. That was a transforming place for me. Now, I tell you this, I'm the world's worst timekeeper in the world. The world's worst timekeeper in the world. Is that redundant or what? I tell you what, I'm just going to globally visit this, the steps. I believe I started at 8:10, I believe is when I started. Close. Yes, an injuncture here, and I don't want to do an injustice, but it's a critically important thing to me, is that what just happened in that fourth step was a resoundingly important thing where I got down to dealing with causes and conditions. I started to get a glimpse of what defects of character were. Yeah, I always thought defects of character was naughty behavior. You know, just stuff I did that was inappropriate. They put me in jail for it. You know, that's not defects of character, that's behavior. You know, defects of character are the flaws in the development of my character. And I won't elaborate on it, but, you know, all of us, I mean, we all grow up and are influenced by the environments we grew up in, of course. And in my environment, I took a few shots, and I had some wounds, and I had some things that affected how I function. And they developed my character around ways to cope with the wounds, you know. And so what that produces is a guy that has some sort of abnormal means of developing life. I developed things we call defects of character. I developed a lot of fear about everything, about nothing. Fear. I developed anger. Not about anything, but it's developed anger as a kind of mechanism for dealing with people. A lot of insecurity. I developed an awful lot of things that of dishonesty. I became an absolutely consummate liar. I mean, I'd lie when there's no reason. And I put that in the past tense. I'm still instinctively a liar. I have to plan to tell the truth. You know, I'm not just instinctively blurt out the truth. I'm not that well. And you, if somebody gets me in a... Oh, I thought you stole my water. If I get in a tight, somebody makes me explain something real quick, my first reflex will be to lie. And then I have to stop and say, no, you don't need to lie. You'll just tell the truth. But that that defects of character are things that just determine how I function. So that whole business about that inventory process and sharing with another human leads to a very important point that, again, I'll just allude to it, but if you're uncertain about how you move into real recovery, where you start to be free, I hope you'll focus on what I'm just going to skip by. 6 and 7 to me are tremendously important steps. I think they're the fulcrum of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where I get through in the first 3 steps, I basically get a foundation for recovery in those first 3 steps. The next 4 have to do, for me, about my relationship with myself, where I'm dealing with causes and conditions. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm not just a guy who drank too much or bad drunk. You know, that's not me. I'm a guy who has an illness that's complex in nature, whose nature is such that if I don't drink, I get worse. I don't get better. And I'm the kind of guy that simply could not get by. Some people do. But I could not get by on a just don't drink, go to meetings program. I could not do that. I'm somebody who wants desperately to be free. I want to be free. I don't want to live in bondage and fear and having to have some neurotic need to do some little activities all the time. I want to be free. I want to be able to serve and to have purpose in my life. And so I think they're critical things. And 6 and 7, the bottom line is that they're basically decision steps. A lot of people get to those steps and we have to make a decision. We're either going to move on into recovery or else we're going to opt to move into what I call maintenance type of recovery, where we just go to meetings, get what we need, and go home. That's a viable option that many, many people take. I'm not one of them. I'm one who really wants to be free, and that's not enough for me. So some of us need to go deeper. I want to be a free man. And what I believe is that decision in that 6 and 7 basically puts a question to me. Do you want to get well or don't you? Do you want to be free or don't you? Are you willing to take a stand or aren't you? It's decision time. Do you really want to do something? Or you just want to shuck and jive and see how long you can last? I think that's really what it comes down to. And so if I want to do get better, what it does is moves me into what I call the restoration part of the program. The restoration program is made up in the amends and in the practice and the principles. And again, I am just going to slide by, but I tell you this because it's just so important to me that because it is what we're about. This is not about survival 101. It's not about just hanging on and fighting the grim fight. It's not about that. We've got a program that will absolutely not only liberate us, but will make life have real meaning and real purpose and real joy. And it only comes if I do those things. Now, my belief is that when I get through 6 and 7, my belief is that every time I screwed over, misused, abused, took advantage of, insulted, demeaned, whatever, any person, place, or thing, I did not win. I lost. And what I did was pay for that with a piece of my soul. I'm owned by every person I ever took advantage of. I'm owned by everybody I misused or abused. They own a piece of my soul. And the amends process that's laid out in 8 and 9 is about how to be free. My belief is that I will never be a free man until I go make right those wrongs that own me. And I can't forget them. Time won't heal them. I know people who've drug them for 40 years, and they drag them. Yeah, so I believe that in the surgery of Alcoholics Anonymous, the restoration process is how can I make right those wrongs and start to do what's right as a way of life. And no difficult thing. I won't go into the process. The steps are laid out, I think, so clearly. 8 and 9 are as clear an exercise to do in this program as anything I know. It tells us specifically how to do stuff. And so I won't dwell on that. The last three that I just allude to are the steps that sometimes we call maintenance steps. I don't call them main steps. I think they're powerful steps that have to do with putting these principles to work in my life so that they work as a way of life. Sometimes when we look at 10, some people think that's the excuse me and forgive me step. You know, that I think that's the least important function of 10. It's about putting these principles to life. The way I can tell how I'm doing with step 10 is look at how I treat my fellow man. If I'm not treating my fellow man with kindness and concern and courtesy and helpfulness, I ain't doing what's laid out in these principles, because it's about how to put this to work as a way of life. And what happens is when I put these principles to work, my God, I live in a friendly world. I live in an awfully friendly world. And that's the same one that everybody else lives in, same one all of us live in. But I'm amazed at how many people I run into every day of my life who are kind and considerate and courtesy and helpful. And it's because of the way I approach people. I'm because of these principles, not because I'm a naturally nice guy, but because of these principles, I treat every human being I meet as a lady or gentleman. I don't care who they are. I treat them like a lady or gentleman, not whether they deserve it. It's a matter of the way I want to relate to this world. And it's amazing how people respond. Now, once in a while I run into a jerk. I mean, you got some around. But good God, I got enough sense to get rid of a jerk. Good God, I'm not going to stay there and hang out and rap with somebody. I can cut them loose. You know, and go and say, good luck, buddy. Wish you well. But that's the thing. And then finding real useful purpose. The last thing I'd say about that, and then I'm going to have to start getting out of Dodge here right quick. I want to get fired in Portland. I guess this thing of finding real service. You know, some people see service as a separate compartment. I believe that service is an integral part of recovery. Show me a group that has no service life, and I'll show you a weak group. Show me a member who has no service life, and I'll show you a member who's selling themselves short. The real reward of this program is where I start finding real useful purpose. Where do I find self-esteem? It's not by sitting around studying my psyche. I find self-esteem by doing esteemable things. I find things that are rewarding by doing things that pay off. And so service is a natural product of this thing. And so I didn't mean to travel all through the steps, but I mean, what else is there? The 11th one to me is not about getting on a mountain and staring at your navel in that meditation. It's about getting in contact with my God as I understand Him and trying to find out my avenue of service. I believe for every one of us in this program, there's an avenue of service that'll open for us if we practice these principles as a way of life. An avenue of service will open for you. It won't be the same for all of us, but one will open up. And we'll either accept it or reject it. And I personally believe that my growth and development in this program will hinge on that decision. If I don't see service as a natural extension in my recovery, I'm going to sell myself awfully short. And so what happens when I get into that dimension is that life takes on truly a new meaning and a new function. I start to find some usefulness and purpose, and I start to be free because I go back and make right those things and try to find God's will so that I can put it to work as a way of life here. And I'm telling you, man, it's a hoot. I'll kind of wrap up around what I keep saying. I'll wrap up, and I will eventually. people chew me out if I don't tell this. I said I wanted to tell about hope. And I really do want to tell about hope. I don't like to so much, but anyway. Yeah, I'm a guy that, you know, when I was sitting in that joint and when this program worked for me, I tell you this, I don't know if it'll give you any hope or not, but I'll tell you this for a fact. If you don't think this is a powerful program, I described the conditions I was sitting in. That's absolutely true picture of that place. I became a free man in that environment. Excuse me, in that environment, in every sense of the word, except physically. I became a free man. I became a fellow who was able to live with dignity and purpose in that kind of an impossible environment. This is a powerful program. I became a guy with youthful purpose and great rewards. There is no reward that comes from Alcoholics Anonymous that was not given to me in a maximum custody penitentiary. And that's a fact. That's a fact. This thing doesn't rely on what cage you're on or what kind of impairment you have. This thing is about being free at the soul level. And so it worked for me magnificently there. And when I got out, I only stayed in it 3.5 years. They I guess it's remarkable to see somebody do the kind of turnaround that apparently I did. I didn't notice it. I was busy. But I guess they noticed. And I was recommended for special parole when I was only 2 years in there and had a 15-year max. I didn't make it. But I didn't realize that a special parole recommendation happens once every 10,000 cases. And I'm nobody special. I'm just a guy doing this program, being of service. Yeah, and it just, I guess, stands out. And so that assured that I would be paroled on my first eligibility, which was 3.5 years into the sentence. And I was paroled on condition I go to North Carolina. And I didn't want to go. I'd been to the big city. I didn't want to go back to Mayberry, I tell you that. But I readily accepted. You could believe that. And so I went back. When I left the institution, I was like anybody leaving a place. You know, I had some hopes and some dreams. They were little dreams. They weren't a big deal. I just wanted to do things I'd never done. You know, I wanted to hold a job and be a decent employee. I didn't want to be a question mark on the line or in the office or wherever. I didn't want to be that. I wanted to hold a job. I wanted to actually earn a paycheck on a regular basis and be a decent employee. You know, I wanted to wonder truly if I would ever have a friend. Yeah, if anybody would ever trust me again to do anything, if I'd ever have any real useful purpose, if I'd just be a drone just back and forth to the mine every day and know what the idea, but just had a little dream. I wanted to be a citizen. That sounds ridiculous to somebody who's always been a citizen. I'd never been a citizen. I'd never voted. I had never paid taxes. I'd never filled out a form. I didn't do that stuff. Yeah, I wasn't somebody who improved property values. I'm somebody who brought them down. You know, that's, and so I wanted to be a citizen. I wanted to do the stuff that people do, be a part of a community. Those are little things. They're almost no-brainers to people who've always been there. But if you've been somebody who lived in this world by yourself, they start to have meaning. And so I'm here to tell you, dreams come true. Every dream I ever had has come true, and God knows dreams I wouldn't have dared dream. 2 weeks after I was out, some guys were working with a prison. They asked me to go over and visit the prison. I said, man, they're not going to let me go in. I just got out of a maximum custody joint. They're not going to let me go in there. They may not let me out. And they said, nah, it's all right. Come on. And so it was a simpler day then, and so I went over and went to the prison. It's an eerie feeling when you go back in and you're a visitor. You know, it's an odd feeling. You want to get up against the wall. You know, it's just a reflex action. So I went in there and started doing that. 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor. You know, here's the same guy who wondered if he'd ever be trusted by anybody. And I'm asked to take a responsible service position as outside sponsor of a prison. I'm still on parole from the state of Michigan. And so I did. I took that thing. But same time, what I'm going to tell you about here, just right quick, like, are miraculous by any measure as far as I'm concerned. You know, that's a miraculous thing to me. And I'm a very practical fellow. I'm a deeply spiritual man. I'm somebody who believes that the spiritual life really isn't a theory. It's you have to live it. And I believe the spiritual life is either everything or it's nothing. And when I'm living a spiritual life, I believe that miracles happen. I don't believe it. I know it. I know that miracles happen. And to me, in a very practical level, miracles are what happens when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction. That's exactly what happens. It's not some magic show. It's just it's a very, very real expression of the spiritual life. And miracles happen. Because I had things happen that were beyond my imagination, the two I just described. About the same time I became sponsored at prison group, my parole supervisor came to me one day and said, Tom, you're real active as AA thing. And I said, yes, sir. And it bothered me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down, and I knew I wouldn't. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't, like he didn't know. So when I'd left Michigan, I had letters that big on my paper. This man's never drive a motor vehicle ever and never drink alcoholic beverage. I took both of those as literal facts of life. And he said, well, let me take a look at it. Yeah. And a little later he asked me to come up to the Sears store in my town. Now, this does sound like Mayberry, but it's the way it worked. My sister drove me up. She pulled up in front of the Sears store. I could see my guy back there. Walked back there. He was talking to the fellow I didn't know who was a licensed agent. They chatted for a while. Then they turned to me and said, howdy or something. And the driver's license fella handed me a driver's license. Didn't even ask me if I could drive. No test, road, written, verbal, nothing. Didn't pay for it. It cost $4. I don't know if I had $4. They thought I didn't, I guess. I didn't pay. There's some lawyers in this crowd. They won't admit it, but they're here. They'll tell you that there's got to be something legally shaky about that. But I've been driving ever since. You know, I'm talking a long time of driving. And, you know, I've had people tell me, well, you must have been well connected politically. you just heard my resume. You know I was well connected politically. The sheriff and I were intimate friends. Yeah. And I tell you, I really and truly believe that's a miracle of this program. When I give my broken and wasted life to this program, it's amazing what happens. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what the walls are. I know that not only on my own experience, but God knows how many hundreds of people I know with unbelievable stories of restoration. Yeah, that's what this program is about, is restoration. And when God's got work for me to do, if my heart's right and I'm doing what the right thing to do, those walls will come down. I was elected DCM, the trusted servant for AA in 15 communities in my state. Same guy who wondered if he'd ever be trusted. Meant a lot to me. 2 years after I was out, I sit in my house one day, minding my own business, and got a phone call from the state capitol. The guy on the phone was a fellow who worked for the prison system. I'd met him once. He stuck his head in the door, and we chatted for about 2 minutes at the group I sponsored. And I don't know if he came just to see what we were doing. What, doesn't matter. But we just chatted. I didn't know him. I didn't even know his name. But we chatted, and then that was him on the phone. And he said, Mr. Ivester. And I said, yes, sir. And he told me who it was, and I recognized it. He said, we are expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. And the first thing I said, just instinctually, was, do you know who you're talking to? And, man, I just got out of a maximum custody penitentiary a couple years earlier, and I'm still on parole from the state of Michigan, and he's asking me to be an official for the state prison. I said, do you know who you're talking to? He said, oh, yeah, we've checked you out. And, of course, they had. And at that time, it what makes this such an unbelievable, but you believe it, such an unbelievable story, there had never been an ex-con in history hired into a prison system. And I knew they weren't going to pick me to be the trial balloon. But they did. And so I was employed as a rehabilitation officer in the North Carolina prison system. It's a lonely place when you're the only guy on the planet with an experience. Who do you talk shop with? Thank God for AA traditions. Boy, those things did more to give me equilibrium and balance and guidance than I could possibly say. And that really helped me to find my way in a whole brand new world. I'd never done anything at a professional level that I was, well, I mean, did some when I was drunk. But I did not long. But, yeah, I'm moving into something that was scary, to say the least. And I had to decide, am I going to go in there and be a true professional? Or am I going to go in there and be some sort of a counterculture hero? And you know what I'm talking about. It would have been real easy to play up the hoodlum hero type of stuff and would have been on every television show and newspaper in the country. But that's not what I'm about. Yeah, that's not. I'm not a circus freak. You know, I'm a human being being restored to a place in this world and experiencing real miracles in this new life. And so I had to take my place, and I went to work, and I became the best professional I was capable of doing. Finished up my education in correctional administration. And I wasn't ambitious. I'm a good worker. I was a good worker when I could find my job. When I was drinking, I guess, but it just didn't last long, about half a shift, and I was done for. And so I just went to work, and I worked hard. I mean, tell you, I loved every minute. It was a labor of love. Strange thing happens when you do good work, you'll start getting booted up till you get to your level of incompetency, I guess. As I started getting pulled into supervision, then into management, and then directing the program, and then one day the head of our system asked me to come by, that he wanted me to help him with something. It usually meant go pinch hit the speech or something. And so I went by and said, "Yeah, boss, what?" And he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." I mean, even though I'm in the system and have been there for several years, I mean, that is an impossible kind of thing to accommodate. I mean, you know, my God, just a few years earlier, I'm sitting in maximum custody. And I'll guarantee you, among my aspiration was never, I think I'll get out here and run one of these suckers, you know. Never made the list. Yeah, And I told him very little. I said, "Boss, God, I don't know, man. I don't want to be the head screw. That's not my deal. I want to duke it out with the guys." And I really meant that. And then I said, "Tell me what you got in mind." He told me that it had just enough creativity that I liked it. And that's why he wanted me to do it, because he knew that I was just the kind of guy that will attack the beach no matter who's on it. I mean, I'll just go. That's my style. I'm a creator. I'm a developer. I'm not a maintenance guy. And so he knew that. And he wanted just that kind of an unfettered idiot that would just do stuff. He told me, I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And that started a career. I spent the next 20 years of my life running institutions. And I was the go-to guy for starting new stuff. I had a wonderful, wonderful career. I went to trade with Bill Gates, and that's a fact. What a tremendously rewarding kind of an experience. And then finally, a 39-year service, I realized I was the oldest rat in that barn. And I didn't want to be the oldest rat in the barn, and so I started to plan to retire. And folk are strange people. The word gets around. To be an anonymous organization, we're about as communicative as it. People know I was going to retire. And before I retired, I had already been elected to be the chairman of AA and Corrections the day I retired. So I had the shortest retirement in the known world. It lasted about a tenth of a second, you know, while I signed the paper and then I go to work. And I just say it this way. I didn't want to just jump back into a demanding thing. I've been in a pressure-packed kind of a career for many, many years. And certainly I could have gone, played golf, go to the beach, moved to Oregon or something. But then I thought, I can't walk away from that. You know, when they asked me to do that job, I knew without any question if there was anybody in my state that understood the plight of the alcoholic in prison, it was this guy. I knew most of them. If there's anybody who knew it was me. And if there's anybody who understood the system and had access to it, it was me. And when I've got an opportunity like that to help, and I selfishly walk away, I think I pay a heavy price for that. And so I couldn't. I stepped in and did that, and so I've been head up to my heels. I'm the busiest guy I know. And that's a fact. I'm the busiest guy I know. My wife's not overjoyed with that, but she believes most of the time in what I'm doing, most of the time, when she's not brittle and kind of wants to kill me. So, but it's been an absolute hoot. And so what I've done for the last 48 years is what I told you in the beginning. I've had a marvelous experience. There is nothing in my life that hasn't been enriched by the experience. Same guy who was isolated on this planet. Today, there's not a place in North America that I can go and not have good, warm, close, personal friends. And I'll tell you something. I don't know what your aspirations are, but if you're somebody who wants to live free and breathe deep and have a good sense of joy in what you're doing, for God's sakes, man, don't make this a spectator sport. Don't just sit around and chat. Get into some real purposeful action. Lay back your ears and jump in this sucker. Don't let it go by. All the best.